Hello, this is Christopher John Bjerknes. It is Thursday, June 12th, 2008. I have a new and very interesting guest who has issued some very thought-provoking ideas and theories, and he supports them with a great deal of historical evidence. And I'm going to be discussing that with him today. His name is David Livingston. He has studied the historical roots of Western civilization and has a very different point of view on the source of those ideas which we consider to be Greek, those ideas which we consider to be Christian, and those ideas that we consider to be Judaism. And he traces the lineage of these ideas back to Babylon and to the Kabbalah and the occult and the mystery religions. David, are you there?
I'm here. Hi. Nice. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming. It's a great pleasure to speak with you. I listened to your interview with Henry Markov, as you know, and I found that very interesting and very thought-provoking. It led me down avenues I hadn't explored before, and it led me to think about all the things that I've researched myself which support your thesis. And in some respects, we're in disagreement, but I'm very interested to know what you have to say. Can you give us a summarization of your worldview of Western civilization and how in its cultural, historical, artistic, and societal aspects it came to be?
Sure. Basically, it would be the thesis of my book called titled The Dying God, The Hidden History of Western Civilization. I call it the hidden history because what I do is I uncover the role of the occult, which has been completely neglected by mainstream historians. But it's only by looking at the occult that you can properly interpret what's being offered as the history of Western civilization. But ultimately, there is no such thing as Western civilization or history of Western civilization. It's a modern invention. It goes back to largely the turn of the century when it was Rockefeller and Carnegie decided to appropriate the American education. The Rockefeller created the General Board of
David,
Education.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You cut out for a couple of seconds there.
I did. Okay. Where did you lose me? Where should I start?
You were talking about Carnegie and Rockefeller, and I would add that they were great influences in the American educational system and deliberately tried to turn Americans away from higher education and towards the trades and other things, especially in New York City, around the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. But I'm sorry, but you were cutting out right at that point.
Well, they actually took over the entire higher educational system, the university system of the United States. There's an excellent book on it called Universities in a Capitalist State by Clyde Barrow. He takes a bit of a leftist interpretation of it, but despite that, his analysis is very detailed, and he doesn't offer any theories. He just offers you case by case of how these two boards of trustees essentially took over the university system. And what they did, essentially what they needed in World War One was a reason to justify America's involvement in the war. So basically they created this notion of America actually being part of Western civilization, which they shared with England and France, and opposed to the East. And it was largely from that point on that this notion of a Western civilization is being promoted. But ultimately it comes back from Hegel. And Hegel was the first to suggest, because up until the time of Hegel, there was a common acknowledgement that Greek civilization, because this has been a recurring theme throughout history, that Greek civilization derived many of its ideas from the East. But it was Hegel who first suggested that yes, okay, ideas from the East, but the influence was minimal, and it was the Greek genius that transformed it. And his idea of that is basically what led to the complete neglect of Eastern influence on Greek civilization and the idealization of of Greek society. And we also have to wrap into that his interpretation of history, which is ultimately derived from the Kabbalah. It's derived specifically from Lurianic Kabbalah.
Now, when you speak of Hegel, we are talking about a highly influential German philosopher who applied the dialectical method to history and said that history was a struggle of forces and that great men made history. And he also tried to define cultural and societal norms in a way that could very easily fit in with the Kabbalah. And he was influential on Marx and many other people.
Absolutely. The reason Hegel is popular, because otherwise there's no reason for it, is because he's the great oracle of the Illuminati. And it makes sense when you see that his philosophy was derived from Isaac Luria. And Isaac Luria developed what's called the New Kabbalah, or Modern Kabbalah, which would be in the 16th century.
Yes.
And so the notion that he developed was the idea that God needed an other to know himself. And so he created an other of himself, which was man.
Now, do you view that as a dialectical process where you have the thesis and the antithesis forming a synthesis?
Essentially. So the history of humanity is man or God coming to know himself. So man progresses from the lowest of knowledge and advances through history, growing intellectually until he finally reaches the end of history, when you get the Superman of Nietzsche, who is the first to be able to finally proclaim that he is God, he thinks he recognizes that he is God.
The Uberman.
This is the Antichrist, of course. And this is how the idea of Greece as the cradle of civilization was born. That Greece was supposedly the first free thinkers, which means that because religion is considered the most backward form of human intellectualism, and the pinnacle of human intellectualism is atheism or Kabbalah. So kind of the birth of the intellectual progress of man would have supposedly begun with the Greeks, who questioned religion, and the philosophers were the first to look outside themselves and try to define what they believe reality to be. This is completely incorrect. And it's all part of this modern myth-making about Greece. The Greek philosophers were not rejecting religion, they were rejecting the traditional pagan faith, but they were replacing it with Kabbalah. And this is where I have to do some explaining. Do you want to interrupt any point, or should I keep going?
Well, I wanted to read a brief quote from Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche. He said, and I quote, "The Sophists were Greeks. When Socrates and Plato took up the cause of virtue and justice, they were Jews or I know not what." And that is a quote from The Will to Power, edited and translated by Walter Kaufman, published by Vintage Books, New York, 1968, page 234. And Nietzsche railed against Christianity as a form of Judaism and against the Greeks because he saw that they were sophists who were trying to destroy traditions. And you're focusing on religious traditions that they sought to destroy. And Nietzsche said that they did this by idealizing things in ways that weren't natural, and by taking man out of the context of his existence as an animal and placing him in an ideal sphere which does not exist, and that this was counter to science and counter to reason, and that the Greeks should not be lauded as if the pinnacle of reason and logic, because in effect they were destroying reason and logic.
Well, I think that's Nietzsche's interpretation. I don't think that's the one that was absorbed into the common myth of Western civilization. I think that, despite his opinion, the Greek philosophers were considered the founders of reason, which supposedly
absolutely
reached its pinnacle of the Enlightenment.
And the pinnacle of logic was the syllogism.
Yes, I suppose. But essentially, you see, what historians forget to remind people is that that Greek philosophy came to life in the 6th and 5th century BC, not in the Greek mainland, but on the western coast of Turkey, in Ionia. And that was a part of the world that was, at the time, under Persian occupation. So it's funny that we don't refer to that as Persian philosophy, but as Greek philosophy, merely because it was in the Greek language. But it's obvious when you scrutinize it that it was founded on Persian, or should I more specifically say Babylonian influence. So the first thing we have to do to understand about it is you have to look at the birth of the Kabbalah. And Kabbalah, usually when people use the term, it refers to the mystery, the mystical tradition in Judaism that began in the late 12th century Europe. But it's understood to have had a much more distant past, and that past is located back in the Merkaba tradition, which really flourishes in the first century AD. So the question is what produced this evolution? What influences brought about the emergence of Merkaba mysticism in Judaism? So there's various claims that, you know, it was partly Greek, that maybe it was partly Iranian. So there's a confusion as to, or I guess Egyptian in some cases, or Gnostic. There's a confusion as to which direction the influence would have come from. And the confusion that it's not recognized that the Greeks, in turn, got their influence from Babylon as well. And the way we can identify that is that, first of all, we have to go, if we look at at Merkaba and the emerging Kabbalistic ideas of the first century AD, they're all similar to ideas that were associated to who were called the Chaldean Magi, or a Babylonian Magi. Now, I try to keep this as simple as possible, but it gets complicated. So please call me back if I stray too far. But it gets into detail, unfortunately, which is a little thick. But this has confused scholars because when they look at Persia, the Persians were following the religion of Zoroaster, and the Magi were supposed to be Zoroastrians. So they compare Greek philosophy or early Kabbalistic tradition, compare it to Zoroastrianism, and they say, look, there's no similar, it's not possible for Zoroastrianism to have influenced Greek, and if it did, only very, very, very slightly. What they don't understand is that there were two Zoroastrian traditions. There was one which was Orthodox and the other one which was Heterodox. And so in our time, the tradition that we have become familiar with Zoroastrianism is the Orthodox one. But in the ancient world, outside of Persia, the mystics through whom the rest of the world came to know Zoroastrianism were the Heterodox Zoroastrians. And these they called Chaldean Magi. And they had nothing to do with Orthodox Zoroastrianism. It was a thorough heresy and a thorough bastardization of Zoroastrianism. Had no relation to it. It was basically mystery schools that appropriated Zoroaster and a whole stream of Babylonian.
May I interrupt?
Pardon?
May I interrupt?
Yes.
Do you believe that there was such a person as Zarathustra, and that the historical source of Zoroastrianism has a foundation, and how did this split occur into heretical views of it, the way that Christianity broke off into Gnosticism and then was codified in the Council of Nicaea?
Exactly. Well, we have to understand, first of all, that the occult tradition throughout its history has been based on pseudo-epigraphical works, right? So most of the works are ascribed to certain religious figures, but didn't really belong to him. So like the Book of Enoch, which it was claimed to have been written by Enoch. And there's books of Abraham and books, right? Just like the Gnostic books ascribe books to Jesus or Mary Magdalene and so on and so forth. It's part of this occult tradition of creating these these pseudo claims. And Zoroaster would be very much the same. And I believe that probably some of the Greek philosophers, they did the same with a lot of some of the Greek philosophers. So Gnostic books were attributed to Zoroaster early on, before Gnosticism emerged. In fact, they were, anyway, that's too complicated. They're attributed to Zoroaster, but they weren't, he had nothing to do with them at all. It's just part of the culture, the occult culture of appropriating certain characters, I guess, for some form of disguise or legitimacy or whatever it is, whatever purpose that they
or proselytizing.
Have. Yeah, exactly. And so, yes, I do believe there was a true Zoroastrian faith. I believe it was monotheistic. But it was misappropriated, and that took place in Babylon. So when you go back to the ideas that emerged in Merkaba and you compare them to the ideas that were attributed to the early Magi, it's obvious that they're essentially identical. But most of these ideas were new. And at what point can we identify their emergence? And it's very easy. They emerged pretty much all of a sudden in the middle of the 6th century BC.
Which is the time... the time of the exile of the Jews, supposedly.
Absolutely. So the majority of the Jewish population were being held in exile in Babylon at the time. And this also happens to be the century when astrology emerges and becomes kind of the core philosophy of the emerging occult tradition. And and it's basically right after this time, also somewhere around there that Zoroaster emerges, but it's also after this time that you have the emerging influence of the Magi.
Now, the exile was supposedly brought about by God as punishment for the Jews for apostasy. Do you believe that there is a relationship between the emergence of these occult beliefs and the exile of the Jews?
Absolutely, because at the heart of this Magian cult was the worship of Mithras. So this is in contradiction to true Zoroastrianism, although there is some reverence for a Mithraic character. But Mithras was the Persian version of the dying god, and the Babylonians had their own version. It was Marduk or Baal. The Jews had been worshipping Baal, and but otherwise he's basically, you know, just like the Egyptians had Osiris, there's many versions all over the place. The Greeks had Dionysus and so on and so forth, but so Mithras was the Persian version. And what they did, so they exchanged names is pretty much all they did. So they retained this pagan tradition which they had falsely adhered to for, I guess, nearly 1,000 years until the exile, and now disguised it in Persian theology by giving Baal the name of Mithras. But otherwise, the occult practices were the same. It involved mystery rites, it involved human sacrifice and intoxication and black magic and all the same things that were traditionally involved in the practice of the worship of Baal. So that's essentially what happened. And presumably what happened was that the heretical Jews in Babylon, who instead of seeing the exile as a sign from God and an encouragement for them to reform their ways, they instead choose to amalgamate their paganism to their interpretation of, or they disguise their amalgamation of this paganism as an interpretation of the Bible, which eventually gets called Kabbalah. But it's essentially the ancient worship of the dying god and the mystery practices that are involved with it.
Now, if I understand correctly, the belief in Mithras incorporates the idea of a Messiah, which would be very appealing
yes.
to the Jews in exile because they sought after a king who would come and conquer and restore them to Palestine and build the temple again.
Right. And obviously, there's a lot of cross influence there.
Do you believe that messianic ideas are a part of Kabbalah from way back?
I think messianic ideas are just part of human history. So, I don't think they're exclusive to Judaism or Christianity or Islam. So, I believe they would have rightfully emerged in Zoroastrianism as well, but like in every other faith, it gets misappropriated and used for other. The idea of a Messiah is just being misappropriated by the Kabbalah for its own devious purposes.
So we have the Jews in exile in Babylon, we have Persia as an emerging influence, and we have the Jews entering into an apostasy of the cult of Mithras.
Right.
And this is the emergence of Kabbalah. This is the soup that brews Kabbalah.
It is the Kabbalah, yeah. In fact, there's Daniel himself is supposed to be one of the wise men. To say that from early on, there wasn't a perceived contradiction in being belonging to the wise men of Babylon and remaining within the Jewish faith.
So you do not believe that Moses had a Kabbalah, or that a Kabbalah was presented at Sinai?
Absolutely not.
Okay. And that's an important distinction.
Yes. That's the great myth. That's the great lie. Moses was a true prophet, and the Kabbalah is the ultimate heresy. So, the key point is at this time in history, the world, except for presumably the Babylonians, were pretty much unaware of the Jewish people or of their distinction from other races or cultures. Because even Herodotus, in the mid-5th century BC, when he is in Palestine, he describes as circumcising themselves. He believes that they are remnants of an Egyptian colony, which obviously refers to the Exodus. But he doesn't call them Jews. He doesn't refer otherwise to a different faith or Moses. He just calls them Phoenicians and pretty much characterizes them as indistinguishable from the people of that coast.
And there were also other things that were in common with the Jews, if I remember correctly. They buried their dead, which was uncommon practice at that time. The priests were clean-shaven and practiced cleanliness rituals.
Right.
And other things that Herodotus identified, but he never specified that there were any tribes. He never mentioned Judah, and this was used against the Jews about the time of Christ to say that they had fabricated their history and fabricated their religion, and Josephus goes into those issues in his book Against Apion.
Right. And in fact, the point of the Jews being identified with Phoenicians is very significant, because there have been a series of studies recently, primarily by Walter Burkert, who is considered one of the leading scholars in the area, and M.L. West as well. They're reconsidering the role of Phoenician influence in the emergence of Greek society. And it's obvious that the two were intertwined. And the funny thing is that this was mentioned by the early historians as well. Of course, the alphabet has always been known to have been derived from the Phoenicians. So essentially, the word alphabet comes from what's close to the Hebrew aleph. What would be the equivalent in Hebrew for the aleph, beth, and right? Get my point, I hope.
Yes.
This is
not controversial. This is very well known history.
This is very
well
known. It's very well known. In fact, the common Greek was brought to Greece by Cadmus, whose father was Phoenix from Phoenicia. So there's no, like you said, there's no controversy there. And more particularly, there's one historian named Hecateus of Abdera in, I believe, the 3rd century BC or 4th. He said that there was a colony of Jews. When they left, there was an Egyptian colony. When they left Egypt, some of them settled in Palestine under a leader named Moses, but the rest, or a number of them, kept going and went all the way into Greece, and they came to be known as Cadmus and Danaus. And this is the famous myth in the myth of origin among the Greeks about Danaus as being one of the early settlers of Greece, having derived from Egypt. Relates with the tribe Dan. And this is stuff I get into a little more detail in my book. Maybe we don't have to get into, like, a scaling law topic. But it's just to say that from very early on, from at least the 8th century B.C., there's already a strong correlation between Greek culture and Jewish culture, or Israel, in a sense. That Greek culture already, from inception, seems to have emerged out of a great degree of Jewish influence.
Why would you say that there was such animosity between the Greeks and the Jews and the Maccabeans and Antiochus in that period, and why would they view it as Hellenization to adopt Greek culture if there was a commonality between the two? Or are you saying that it was an influence among some Greeks who then became prominent philosophers and are identified as being Greeks, but Hellenic society itself had its own identity?
Well, both. I mean, the Greek was fundamental. So, the Greek alphabet was essentially Hebrew. So, or derived from Hebrew. So, and yes, it did also influence elites. But the influence of Hellenism really didn't come until Alexander. So that was much later.
Mm-hmm.
So that issue and. You know, I guess it was kind of the overt paganism of Greek culture, which was difficult to accommodate, despite the fact that it was being practiced esoterically anyway.
Do you believe there was an alliance of Persians and Jews? And if so, why were the Persians enemies of the Greeks but friends of the Jews?
Persians the enemies of the Greeks? I don't know. This is mysterious as the many supposed alliances or entities that exist in our time, I think so.
I'm just wondering what you view as the political alliances between the Hellenes and the Jews at that period, at the period of the exile.
But I guess Cyrus was kind of viewed as a bit of a savior, right? And he's the one who...
Yes, absolutely.
Who released the Jews from captivity. Then there also you have the very important case of Esther, who was the one who appealed to the Persian king to...
slaughter Haman and his followers.
Exactly.
Now,
and then, so she marries the Persian king, and this is actually a point that gets into my next book. But anyway.
Well, let's tie this back to what constitutes the Greeks. When we think Greeks, we think of Plato. Many people around the world will know him as Plotinus. We think of Socrates, Socrates. We think of Heraclitus. And we think of Parmenides and the Eleatic school.
The key point is that Greek philosophy emerged in Ionia, which is on the western coast of Turkey, then under Persian occupation. And the Magi had already spread to that part. Not the Orthodox Zoroastrianism, but the heretical form. In fact, there's probably the greatest scholar of the last century was a Belgian named Frantz Cumont. And, you know, unlike... The scholars in our time tend to specialize in a certain field, so we have scholars who specialize in Greek civilization, and a few who might specialize in some ancient Eastern civilization. But there's very few who specialized in ancient culture in general, which is what he did. So he had a particular perspective on the situation that others have missed. And I think that most scholars are too lazy to investigate it thoroughly. And like I said, because they don't see any Zoroastrian influence specifically, they tend to deny his theories on the whole. But what he pointed out was that, in fact, it was heretics, and he calls them Majuseans. And he said that it was the Majuseans who spread across Turkey. And instead of practicing Zoroastrianism, they practiced this mixed cult of Babylonian magic and you know, including astrology and things like that. And it was these, with these magicians, that the Greeks came into contact with. So when you look at the ideas of the pre-Socratics, it's obvious that they were influenced by the Magi, because their first issues have to do with the rotation of the planets, with the four elements, pantheism, and things of that nature.
Are you discussing Pythagoras and others?
All of them, including Heraclitus. So, there's something else that scholars missed, is that there was claims that the Magi used to practice mystery rites. And again, there's no mystery rites in Zoroastrianism. But it's they were already practicing mystery rites. So
you're saying the harmony of the spheres and all the other ideas that entered into Greek thought are Kabbalistic and relate
to the influence of the Magi.
I see.
Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't some degree of, you know, modification, but I believe that the prominent philosophers, particularly Pythagoras and Plato, weren't just influenced by Kabbalah, they were actually the great exponents of Kabbalah. So just as much as Isaac Luria would be considered an innovator in the Kabbalah, Plato and Pythagoras would have been as well. So they're within the tradition, they're not just influenced by it.
One of the things we admire about the Greeks and about the supposed Renaissance man who would be a throwback to the Greeks was their knowledge in various subjects and their philosophies, which addressed man as a complex being and with many aspects to his nature and to the nature of the world. Now, Kabbalah can be viewed as a history. It can be viewed as a set of prophecies. It can be viewed as a method of thought. It can be viewed as a political approach. And all of these elements, these diverse elements, you find in congruence with the thought that the Greeks produced. Is that correct?
Well, you know, when you look at the Zohar, which was developed in the, you know, when people say they're interested in Kabbalah, I never understand why, because I can't imagine what aspects they could be interested in. I mean, if you read the Zohar, it's an immense book with all kinds of multivariate speculations. So what aspect is it that they find inspiring? It's so huge, you know, it doesn't make any sense. But so that's not what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the original core ideas that are the foundation of the Kabbalah. And those you will find in the mystery schools and in Merkabah mysticism. And it's a few basic ideas. They're usually based on the idea of a dying god, essentially, a death and rebirth ritual, ascension through the planets towards union with this god.
And you find that in congruence with the Greeks. Can you specify certain Greeks, for example, Plato and his Republic, and Timaeus and Critias,
right,
and how it is Kabbalah-like? We have to create a commonality of elements to support your thesis.
Right. So the first thing we have to go back to is, as I said, the Magi used to practice mystery rites dedicated to Mithras. So when these were appropriated by the Greeks, they came to be known as the Mysteries of Dionysus. And the evidence for this is Heraclitus, who said so himself in the 5th century BC, who said that the rites of Dionysus, that is the phallic rites, were dedicated to Pluto, which is the devil, and Dionysus, which is the same, and that they were in imitation of the Magi. So it's clear. There's no doubt about it. And there is actually a piece of archaeological evidence that was also discovered dating from approximately the same time that repeats the same claim that the Dionysic mysteries were an imitation of the Magian mysteries.
So you're focusing on the occult beliefs, the religious philosophy, and the ritual practices.
Right. Because the Mysteries of Dionysus became the basis of the cult of Orphism, or of Orpheus. And interestingly, Orpheus was, what's the connection? Was he the son of Musaeus and numerous ancient authors claim that Musaeus was Moses. So already way back, at least it's going as far back as the 3rd century BC. See, there's an idea of Orpheus as being of Jewish origin. And so the great exponent of Orphism was Pythagoras. And the leading student of Pythagoras was Plato. And the Kabbalistic influence in Plato is most obvious, like as you mentioned, in the Timaeus. The Timaeus mentions, refers to the god as being one of three, an offspring and a spouse, which is basically just the ancient pagan trinity.
And this also relates to Pythagoras and Aristotle, the idea that three is a divine number, and
presumably, yeah, because well, yes, I think so. Yes, and it's fundamental. Wherever you find the cult tradition, you'll find that the divine God is part of a trinity. It's a key concept.
Not only that, but Plato asserted that man is part of a trinity, that he has urges. Freud plagiarized Plato's work with the id, the ego, and the superego.
Right.
That, again, it relates to the dialectical method of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis.
Right.
I'm sorry,
so,
I...
go ahead.
No, please, you go ahead.
Yeah, so basically there's just numerous influences in Plato that are obviously imagined influence, but the Timaeus is the most obvious. There's people around him. There's Eudoxus, who was considered kind of the expounder of Persian doctrine to the Greeks. He replaced Plato as head of the academy in Plato's absence. So there were definite connections there. But most particularly, the Timaeus, and aside from the Trinity, it speaks, basically the point is that the ultimate purpose is to study these stars, because stars influence the brain, and stars lead you to an understanding of number, and number is the key to philosophy. All very esoteric.
Number and form.
Yes, which is why I never understood why Plato was so famous, but it makes sense if you understand that he was an esoteric philosopher. And that's principally the key.
Now, when you speak of Plato, you're speaking of demiurge, you're speaking of creation of the universe from pre-existing parts, you're speaking of man coming to know God, you're speaking of different classes of men segregated based on their ability to absorb knowledge. You're speaking of communal sex practices. Many things that are very similar to Kabbalah. Can you address some of those?
Well, I just think that, you know, based on that, because the other very important key securing the fact that Plato was influenced by Kabbalah is the myth of error at the end of the Republic. So in the Republic, Plato goes on and on about, you know, his vision for this ideal place, ideal fascist state, and then which is to be ruled by philosopher kings, and then he's asked, well, what are these philosopher kings to be instructed in? So he gives a myth of Er. And Er is an Armenian who dies, so an Armenian soldier who dies and is resurrected. And this is very interesting because the Armenians recur throughout the occult tradition. The single family during the Crusades that the French Crusaders intermarried with in the Middle East were Armenians. Weishaupt supposedly got his secret doctrines from an Armenian. It goes on and on and on. So it's funny that Plato resorts to Armenian for his ultimate secret doctrine as well.
It's very interesting because Josephus and other ancient historians identify Armenia as the seat of the Garden of Eden and the seat of mankind.
And of the Lost Tribes.
And of the, absolutely.
Because basically the Lost Tribes were first settled there and then moved on from there into other places like Central Asia and Southern Russia.
And they were encircled by rivers and all other kinds of things which describe Armenia.
Exactly. So in the myth of Er is really key for the Kabbalistic tradition. It has, you know, it has the muses and the rainbow and the pillar into the sky, the two spheres, which is the zodiac and the celestial equator, all the key symbolism.